Good morning, everyone. This is Jeffrey Swartz with my colleague, Brendan Berry. We are both professors of law at WMU Cooley Law School, and this is the part of the hour that we are given every week on Westchester on the Level called The Constitution Today. Sometimes we digress off of the Constitution, but we try to get there as much as we possibly can. Let me just say that the comments and the opinions expressed by Brendan and myself are strictly our own. They are not those of the administration of WMU Cooley Law School or its faculty at large. Okay, with that disclaimer out of the way, good morning, Brendan. How are you?
Good morning, Jeff. How are you doing on this muggy, muggy morning in Tampa?
In Tampa, yes. It's been raining now for off and on now for about 36 hours. Yeah. It is hot. It is muggy. It is oppressive. Yeah. It is awful. Okay.
Right.
But then
Other than that, it was just lovely.
This is just the place to be in the summertime. I want to tell you that.
Yeah, right, right.
That's why people who live here leave during the summer. Right. But I will say, you know, but then my daughter was suffering with 102 degree temperatures in Colorado yesterday, so you know maybe it ain't so bad. But it's not a good day. It's gonna be raining most of the day. Got a little sunshine right now, but not won't last long. So for those of you who have good weather, enjoy it. because who knows how long it will last. There is climate change. We haven't ever talked about that.
Yeah, that's
true. Okay, we've never talked about that because I don't know how the Constitution comes to bear.
No.
I have a constitutional right to good weather. Change it. Here's the equal protection issue. I'm kind of really off to a rip-roaring start, aren't I? we have a section or a part of the a show every week where Brendan and I sound off about something that's happened in the past week or something that's been bothering us for years since we were childhood that we call What Do I Really Think? And since I can't remember my childhood because I am so old, I have to reflect upon things that happened yesterday. My big complaint, and this is not the first time I've spoken of her, the congresswoman from the 14th district of Georgia, commonly referred to as MTG, Marjorie Taylor Greene, on Monday decided weeks after she had made certain statements that it might be time for her to do something drastic like apologize because she had gone home to her district last weekend and gotten an earful from a number of her constituents. In addition to that, she's also is, I believe, still about to get a real earful from the House of Representatives because there will be a censure resolution filed against her, which would further diminish her. She's been removed from committees. She really has nothing to do all day except for walk in and vote on things that have to be voted on. That's all she has to do, which I think is kind of a bad thing because idle hands are the devil's workshop. But in this particular case, she may be further diminished to the point where she will not be allowed to speak on the floor of the House. Just vote. That's all. In other words, she is completely neutered as a congressperson other than the vote, which, of course, will make her constituents even more unhappy. The essence of this the complaints against her was a comment that she had made where she literally compared the wearing of face masks to wearing of yellow stars by Jews in Europe during the Holocaust. And she had continuously declined to walk these comments back. She did decline in her statement to walk back her comparison of the Democratic Party here in the United States to the National Socialist Workers' Party. It should be noted, as again, that Bradley Schneider, who is a Democrat from Illinois, has prepared and will be apparently filing a resolution of censure for this Holocaust statement. Now, Marjorie Greene gets out there and she says, my father taught me, and I can't believe that she really remembers what her father taught her, but her father taught me that when you make a mistake, you should own it, and described her comments as a mistake. They weren't a mistake. She repeated them several times. She means what she says. And what's really appalling by this is here is a Nazi calling other people Nazis. This is a woman who avowedly is anti-Semitic, avowedly is a QAnon follower. She is, for all intents and purposes, a Nazi. What was her mistake? I think under her breath and in the back of her brain, she's saying to herself, my big mistake was saying what I really think out loud. I should know better than to do that. It's not that I don't feel that way. It's just that all those Jew colleagues of mine get upset and want to censure me. And that's what I'm really sorry about. Don't sit there and play games and say that you aren't what you say you are. I've said this 100 times on this show. I'll say it 100 times more. When Maya Angelou said, and I believe this to be true, when somebody tells you who they are the first time, believe them. She has told us who she is. She's made it abundantly clear. To sit there and try to soothe Jewish voters in her district and around this country by saying, today I went to the Holocaust Museum. There are no words, followed by in parentheses, of the joy I felt at what I saw. I know these words are offensive, and I apologize for being offensive, but I don't apologize for the thought. She compared a supermarket's face mask policy to the labeling of Jews with a Star of David. At an America First rally around the same time she made those comments, she compared the Democratic Party to the Nazi Party. Despite the name, the Nazi Party was never a socialist party. The National Socialist Workers Party was not a socialist party. But yet she continues to say words like, you know, Nazis were the National Socialist Party, just like the Democrats are now a National Socialist Party. Neither statement is true. Nothing that comes out of her mouth is true. I feel like I'm in the last episode of Star Wars when Han Solo looks at Kylo Ren and says, nothing you just said is true. I mean, I don't understand, and I will never understand the 14th District of Georgia. You should be ashamed of yourselves. You should be embarrassed to an inch of your life. Why no one has asked for a recall vote on this woman who sees herself as some sort of, I don't know, Mary Magdalene from the Nazis, is doing this. I do not understand why they are not doing something about her. She can do nothing for your district. She can do nothing for you personally. She cannot perform any favors for her constituents. She can do nothing. She is useless to you. Send her back to whence she came. Her apology rings with absolutely no sincerity. It is one of the most disingenuous things I have ever read. And believe me, politicians say things that are disingenuous all the damn time. But she's the worst. Well, no, actually Jim Jordan's the worst. But she's bordering on it. It is absolutely time for the people of the 14th District to let her know, do not run again. And for a real Republican, if it has to be a Republican, please, a real Republican, to step up and say, well, I can do more for you because she does nothing except for occupy space and use oxygen that should belong to somebody else. And that's what I really think.
Okay. You know, you preemptively sort of addressed one of the questions I had in my mind. Which was, you know, what, you know, you mentioned her constituents giving her an earful when she got back to her district, and question in my mind was that because they were upset at what she, the way she thinks, or as you put it, because she said it out loud? And I think it's probably the latter. And you know, but from the silence emanating from her district, the failure, as you say, to recall or to demand a resignation, I think that that makes it pretty clear that her constituents are not upset about how she thinks. They're upset,
you know,
about
they're really,
her saying it.
You know, they were, many of them were interviewed when she first got elected and started spouting her mouth off, thinking she was invulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them said, yeah, I really wish she wouldn't say those things. It really embarrasses me that she says those things. I really wish she'd keep her mouth shut and do her job. But you know what? They followed up with, but she believes in a lot of the things I believe in.
All right. Right.
That's what all of them would say. Now, I agree. I think that you hit the nail on the head. I think that they don't care that she thinks that way. I think many of them think that way. She lives in a district that's northwest of Atlanta, bordering on Tennessee. And she and I think that they don't like Jews. They don't like blacks. They're still fighting the Civil War. And so she says things that they want to hear. They don't understand what it means. They don't know what it means. They say, I'm a real American. I believe in America. Yeah, okay. So why are you trying to overturn the Constitution? I'm American. You don't like America, leave it. That's my statement to them. I know a couple of people, and I'm not going to name them, and I won't describe where they're from, who've recently become American citizens, but they're Trumpites and they want to overturn the Constitution. They just swore an oath to the Constitution, but they want to overturn the Constitution. You know, if it was up to me, I'd take away their citizenship and send them home. But that's those people in the 14th District.
Yeah.
They think they live in a world of their own up there. They literally do. I mean, you know, the sheriff sees a strange car in town. First thing he does is stop you and frisk you. I mean, it's, you know, we'll talk about somebody like that in Florida a little bit later.
Yes.
But,
indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, you're, right. You're right.
And I don't know how anybody can buy the story that you know, after all of this, you know, her office announced that she was going to have a statement, you know, slash quote unquote apology, after visiting the Holocaust Museum, before she visited the Holocaust Museum.
Right. So it was a,
it's not like, yeah. So it's not like she went to the, you know, went to the Holocaust Museum, had a change of heart while she was there, and then came out and confessed, you know, or expressed her contrition. That's not how it worked. And anybody who could buy that story, that you have to go to a Holocaust museum to learn about the Holocaust? What, there were not other means available?
It could be a product of the public available? School system. So, I mean,
yeah,
it could be
right.
A product of the public school system. I mean, you know.
I don't know, man. That's
well, I don't know either. I really don't. And the whole idea that she, to me, she debased the museum by showing her face there.
Mm-hmm.
That's like a Nazi going in there and trying to replay the good old days.
Yeah, that's
so.
The mindset's unbelievable.
Okay. It does. So where are you going today?
Yeah, I. You know, as always, when I listen to your thoughts in the morning, my mind starts to wander. You know, here and there. And I never know what I'm going to say before I listen to you. But
it's nice to know that I'm thought provoking. Okay.
Yeah, very much so. And I kind of look for, you know, common threads sometimes, you know, running through some of the things we talk about. And what occurs to me is that as Americans, with a couple of the things we're going to talk about here this morning, we have some serious soul searching to do about whether we want to devolve into some kind of authoritarian banana republic or police state at the local level and the national level, or do we want to preserve our democratic republic and the idea of ordered liberty and a free society. To that end, there have it's now come to light because of some good reporting by a number of different outlets that the previous administration, and I think this comes as really no surprise, it's as people keep saying lately, it's shocking but not surprising. It's outrageous but not surprising that the Department of Justice under Donald Trump was up to quite a few shenanigans. First, we learned that they were seeking information, and it's not clear to me exactly what the, you know, I guess it was telephonic / digital information communications of reporters, ostensibly to discover who was leaking information to those reporters. Then it came out that they were also seeking information about members of Congress. And I thought one of the more sinister parts of that story was that not only were they collecting data about members of Congress, they were also looking at some of their family members, including, I believe, Adam Schiff's, one of Adam Schiff's kids. Then it came out, because, you know, that's not bad enough, right, that the Department of Justice is mining information on reporters and members of Congress, all of whom, by the way, happen to be Democrats, just coincidentally. And then it comes out that the DOJ is also looking at information from who was then the sitting White House counsel, Don McGahn. And so this is the stuff of authoritarian regimes. One of the things I've been talking about with students lately is the unwritten constitution. We have our written text. We also, though, have norms and protocols and, I don't know, culture, institutional culture that has evolved over time. And one of the things that's been sacrosanct since the Nixon administration has been what I'll call the wall of separation between the White House and the Department of Justice, that in a free society, the chief executive of the government does not direct investigations and criminal charges. Donald Trump, of course, openly tore down that wall of separation. I imagine anybody listening, it's so obvious that that is a marker of what I'll call accurately a banana republic. That's how we do business in a banana republic. The person in charge prosecutes enemies, protects friends, uses the levers of government, uses the institutions available to him or her to oppress, to spy. And the irony of it all is that Donald Trump came into office wailing that Barack Obama's Department of Justice had spied on him, It goes back to what people note about Donald Trump, which is anytime he accuses somebody else of doing something wrong, you can bet he's doing it himself.
It's exactly what he's doing. It's called projection.
Yes, right. So this, you know, and we can talk about another story that's emerged about the Department of Justice that you and I were talking about this morning. I'll kick it back to you.
Yeah.
But this, I'll say one more thing about it. The fact that, I don't know what you make of this, but the fact that two former attorneys general, Bill Barr and Jeff Sessions, and the former deputy attorney general, Rod Rosenstein, are tripping all over themselves trying to explain how they didn't know anything about this. They're not denying that it happened, by the way. They're just saying, "Oh, I didn't know anything about that." I think that the fact that they are so vociferously trying to distance themselves from this means that something very serious happened here.
I got to think Barr. It looks more like Sergeant Schultz every day. But go ahead. I know nothing. I see nothing.
Okay. Yeah, and he's not alone. He's not alone.
I know, but he looks like
you know.
Him. So, I mean,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah, sorry about that. I just had to do that.
Yeah.
All right. I hope I didn't take you off your train of thought.
No, that's my train of thought was arriving at the station, and so I'll end it this way. It boils down to what we're going to accept as a society. And again, Jeff, there's something we're going to talk about, I hope, this morning, more locally about when I talk about a police state. But we as a society have to make a decision whether we're going down the road of authoritarianism or we're not. That's what I really think.
Okay. You know, I think that when we look at this and we look at what happened and why these subpoenas were issued, there's a number of things that come to mind. Number one, it is hard to imagine. It is absolutely impossible to believe that nobody above four guys, four attorney employees of the Justice Department, all on their own, decided they were going to start issuing subpoenas for phone records of congressmen who the President of the United States railed against on an ongoing basis. He went after Adam Schiff over 500 times in 4 years. And it's hard to imagine they did this on their own without direction from someone. And it is hard to imagine as what they call them, career prosecutors, except for one of them, who is a recent Trump appointee, former assistant U.S. attorney from New Jersey with an unremarkable career, would do this on their own without some superior of theirs knowing what they were doing. They did it through a grand jury. They called a grand jury. They on their own decided the Department of Justice was going to call a grand jury and ask for subpoenas setting forth probably real BS probable cause that they don't even need just to get these phone records, the metadata as they call it, to find out who Adam Schiff or his 13-year-old daughter were talking to. Or any of the others. That's hard to imagine. And if they did do that, then there is no issue whatsoever that Merrick Garland, as deliberate as he can be, has got to act with efficiency and swiftly and say, he's not on mute today.
And
you're not on mute. You're not on mute, Ezzy. Ezzy, you're not on mute.
Too much.
Ezzy, you're not on mute.
They're going to be here what in 2 weeks?
Ezzy, you're not on mute. Ezzy.
4 weeks.
Okay. Well, it's hard to imagine. Okay. that for any reason whatsoever, okay, that somebody up above doesn't know what's going on. And if these guys were reporting directly to the White House, Garland has to just fire them to show them the door instantaneously. One of them has already resigned. But they literally have to show them the door.
Yeah.
Okay. Enough already. But it's hard to, there's no way. The story goes that it started under Jeff Sessions, but it was resumed under Bill Barr. Please explain to me how that wasn't happening as a result of something coming down from Bill Barr. The guy's just an out-and-out liar. He's an embarrassment. He's worse than John Mitchell ever was. He is the most corrupt attorney general to ever serve. My friend Janet Reno has to be rolling over in her grave.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, it's just ridiculous that they think those things. So, I mean, Garland has to move. He has to clean house. He has to go in there and take every single Trump appointee and show them the door because they cannot be trusted.
Right.
They can't be trusted. And that includes Bill Barr's kids who both work there. Show them the door. They serve at the pleasure of the president or the attorney general. Show them the door. Call them in and say, go get your car keys and your hat and your coat. That's all you can take with you. After we're done examining everything in your office, we'll give you your personal effects back. And have security escort them from the moment they're told they're fired to the moment they walk out the door and take away their credentials. And they don't get recommendations for jobs. Go to the RNC and get a recommendation for a job. Don't go to the DOJ.
Yeah.
And with all of that said, go ahead.
Well, I'm wondering whether Garland will do it. We talk about this, talk about a common thread that runs through much of our discussion. Democrats and Republicans play by two different sets of rules. And you see in Merrick Garland somebody who's very, as you say, deliberative, somebody who's trying to return the Department of Justice to some kind of a sense of normalcy. But in the process, he's doing things that if the shoe was on the other foot, the Republicans would never do. For example, he decided to appeal a decision by a lower court judge that directed the release of a memo, right, a Department of Justice memo about some of Trump's misconduct. And so he decided to appeal that lower court decision. He also decided that the Department of Justice will continue to defend Donald Trump in a defamation case, which appears to be involved conduct by Donald Trump that's completely unrelated to his job as president. So he's doing these things. Now, taking those things in isolation, I would say maybe there are good reasons to do one or both of those things. But I hope it's not establishing a pattern of failing to play hardball. I think it's time, as you say, to really clean house in the Department of Justice. If you want to restore the morale of the Department of Justice, you've got to clean house. I agree with you.
Yeah, I just think that every and some of them, and as they say, there may be collateral damage because there may be some very good attorneys who went to work in the DOJ during the Trump years, but unfortunately they are tainted by those who are not good employees that were planted there for specific reasons, like this Demers guy that we're going to talk about a little bit more about in a minute. But the fact of the matter is that the Department of Justice, that he has to move quickly. I don't see him moving quickly to prevent a decision on the ACA argument. It's one of the first things he should have done.
Right.
The first thing he should have done is withdrawn the Department of Justice's prior brief and the position they took on the ACA and filed a new brief and asked for a new oral argument.
Mm-hmm.
It is precisely what he should have done. And yet he has done nothing. And they keep putting off a decision because they're waiting for him to do it.
Right.
That just literally makes no sense.
Right.
So, I mean, I think that deliberateness is good at times, but right now, in essence, they have to be deliberate but swift in their movements.
Mm-hmm.
And they really have to clean house. They really have to do something very, very quickly because I think they're being undermined by these appointees that Trump put in place.
Right.
And one of those appointees was a guy named John Demers. He was appointed the head of the Justice Department's National Security Division not long ago. And he has now decided that he is leaving the department at the end of this month. Essentially, for those who don't know, the National Security Division is a major investigator and was involved in the record seizures of the metadata from Apple with the secretive effect of asking a judge, and I cannot understand for the life of me how that judge extended those gag orders twice at Bill Barr's request after they had gone that far and it had uncovered no evidence whatsoever. And fortunately, there is a Biden administration nominee that's pending before the Senate right now. He became an attorney general, an assistant attorney general in February 2018, the same month that the prosecutors at the Justice Department subpoenaed Apple. So he was initially the guy who set in motion all of this. There's no question about that. He has a long career, and one of them includes a 1.5-year stint as a Supreme Court as a clerk to Antonin Scalia. Well, now you know where he comes from. He's an adjunct professor at Georgetown on national security. But lo and behold, what else did he do? He was also vice president and assistant general counsel at where? Boeing Aircraft. So we know from whence he came. So he leads this idea, and what has come out just recently, just actually last night, was a series of emails between the House, between the White House and the Justice Department in December and January regarding the election. And it shows how Trump's personal assistant, the chief of staff, Mark Meadows, and other people tried to pressure the Department of Justice into investigating these alleged voter fraud claims. The acting attorney general at that time was Jeffrey Rosen, and he was being pushed and pushed and pushed to consider false and outlandish allegations that the election had been stolen and to get the justice to back up these false claims. They show how Rosen dealt with the political pressure, and he was rather adept at doing it. He refused, he literally out and out refused to speak with or meet with Rudy Giuliani, even though Mark Meadows and others had tried to pressure him into doing so. Mark Meadows sought to have Rosen arrange an FBI meeting with a Giuliani ally, which never took place. And what was the subject? The idea that Italy had used technology and satellites to change the votes. Here's a quote. I flatly refused, said I would not be giving any special treatment to Giuliani or any of his witnesses, and reaffirmed yet again that I will not talk to Giuliani about any of this. And this was in an email he wrote to a deputy attorney general by the name of Donahue. The email's list of complaints about voting procedures in New Mexico, alleged anomalies in Georgia, and claims about Italian satellites. I mean, this is bizarre.
And now they're on to bamboo, right? They're
yeah. Well, the bamboo came first. The email show how Trump directed his allies against Rosen.
American Airlines, who is really usually more expensive.
Kurt Olson, who's a private attorney, reached out to John Morin, who is an employee of the Justice Department, on December 29th, asking Rosen, okay, requesting a meeting with Rosen, promising he could meet at the Justice Department on an hour's notice. I really need to talk to you. I'm going to sit in my office and read comic books until you call me.
Easter Sunday.
He even drafted a complaint that was like the Texas, like the lawsuit that the Texas Supreme Court had thrown out challenging the election results, so that the United States government through the Attorney General's office could bring a similar action in federal court. Olson wrote the following, so that you know from where the pressure comes. Okay? The President of the United States has seen this complaint, and he directed me last night to brief A.G. Rosen in person today to discuss bringing this action. I've been instructed to report back to the President this afternoon after the meeting.
Westchester Airport.
Now, where was the pressure coming from? On December 14th, Trump's personal assistant sent Rosen and Donahue a document claiming to show voter fraud in Antrim County, Michigan. By the end of the year, it was clear that the two of them had tired of the pressure campaign from the White House. The email showed that Meadows pushed the Justice Department to investigate the fraud claims being made by a woman by the name of Cleta Mitchell, a lawyer who assisted Trump on his January 2nd call when he pressured Georgia officials to find him votes. Okay? An email on January 1st, Meadows said, allegations of signature match anomalies in Fulton County, Georgia, asking Rosen to have Justice Department officials engage on the issue immediately to determine if there's any truth to this allegation. He's ordering the Justice Department to investigate something. You really got to read. I could go on and on this. I mean, it just is not enough. But I will say this. In the end, okay, in the aftermath of a January 3rd meeting of Trump, Clark, Rosen, and other then Justice Department official by the name of, I can't pronounce his last name, Hovakovin, okay, wrote, it sounds like Rosen and the cause of justice won. He writes this to Demers, and Demers writes back, amazing. I mean, is he amazed that the cause of justice actually won out because he never thought they would? Or is he amazed that people stood up to Donald Trump? I don't know which. But the Department of Justice is filled with poison, and we have to give it an antidote. And we now see just how close we came to the Department of Justice becoming the enforcement arm of the White House.
Mm-hmm.
That's how dangerous it got.
It's paid for.
People got to wake up. They don't want to, but they got to wake up nonetheless.
And, you know, to circle this back to the Constitution, that this really goes to the scope of executive power. And one of the most dangerous ideas that's emerged, and it started sort of in conservative circles in the Reagan Bush 1 era, and has really taken root now among people like Bill Barr. It's called the unitary executive theory.
Unitary executive.
Yep.
It started with Nixon.
Yeah.
It started with Nixon.
Yeah.
If the president does it, it's not illegal.
That's the famous quote. That's right. It's the idea that all personnel, all agencies in the executive branch are under the control of the president. And under this kind of a theory, there is nothing wrong. There can be nothing wrong. There can be nothing illegal or unethical about the president ordering, for example, a criminal investigation of one of his or her political enemies.
Breaking into the Watergate.
Yeah, right. It's a very dangerous theory, and again, falls in line with this impulse that so many people seem to have to abide authoritarianism in the United States. And one wonders whether the founders should have divided up, you know, since they call it the unitary executive, you know, unit one, whether the founders should have divided up the executive branch, right? We have one political executive whose job it is to execute national policy and separate out law enforcement. But again, you know, instead of amending the Constitution to actually separate the Department of Justice and the White House, we developed what I called earlier an unwritten, right? But these are unwritten rules. It's an unwritten Constitution. But again, it was well understood until recently that the White House and the Department of Justice should be operating on two separate tracks. And we now see how dangerous it is. Because look, what we've talked about this morning, investigating reporters, investigating members of Congress, investigating Donald Trump, investigating, or it looks like initiating an investigation of his own White House counsel, and then trying to reverse an election. And I tell you what, you say people need to start paying attention, that's for sure, because the fact that they failed last time doesn't mean that they'll fail next time. Yeah, I just wanted to throw that out there.
How can I say this? Adolf Hitler tried to overthrow the German government in 1923. He succeeded in 1933.
Right.
Okay? He learned you don't overthrow the government from outside. You overthrow the government from inside.
Right.
That's the way it works. And that's exactly what was happening here. That's like
right.
Okay, people just won't. And I come back to this. I've said this 1,000 times. I'll probably say 1,000 times more. Okay? Many of these people who are backing this thought process are the same people who rely upon the Constitution to keep their guns. That's their big thing. Second Amendment this, Second Amendment that. Sorry, if you overturn the Constitution, there is no Second Amendment. And there is no strong man in this world who allows his populace to have guns and weapons of war. I'm sorry. And I don't want to hear you say they'll take my gun out of my cold, dead hand. You know what? That won't bother them in the least. Okay, here's a bullet for your chest. Now your hand is cold. I've got your gun. And they won't care. And if for whatever the reasons are, they just don't want to accept that. They think that we're going to throw out all of the Constitution except for the Second Amendment. That's going to be our Constitution.
Right.
I've said before that Donald Trump, by the middle of his second term, if he had gotten one, would be standing on the steps of the Supreme Court burning the original Constitution of the United States, burning the original that's in the archives, burning the original and saying, from now on, we don't have a Constitution until we get a new one that meets my approval.
Yeah.
And then we'll have
the
an election. I am the Constitution, and I will tell you what the Constitution is. And at that point, there is no Second Amendment, you bozos. Honest to God, grow up.
Dulles Airport.
I think we should call this entire hour today. What do you really think?
Oh God, you know you set me off. You do it on purpose.
Yeah.
Okay, and this is payback for what I did to you that day over the judge down in Texas. Okay.
Right.
Okay. All right. We shared an article. We only have about. We've got about 15 minutes left, so we can talk about this now. We shared an article that just last week received a Pulitzer Prize from the Tampa Bay Times. And the article describes the activities of the sheriff of Pasco County, which is just north of Hillsborough, which is Tampa, where he is engaging in conduct and has his deputies engaging in conduct to harass the parents of people who have been of kids who have been in juvenile court that he wants basically out of the county because they're going to grow up to be criminals. He's determined that now, and he harasses these people. You just got done reading the article. Tell them what the article's about.
2 a.m., 5 a.m.
I read it yesterday.
Yeah, I thought it was shocking. So apparently the sheriff, President Narco is his name. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah, Narco, yeah.
He's decided that without any due process, probable cause, or any, you know, these trifling details that that we concern ourselves with under constitutional principles, that he has developed algorithms and systems for determining who is going to commit what crimes, where and when in the future. And so he's going to try to be, quote-unquote, proactive. And go ahead and harass these people until they either move out or sue. It goes back to the question I was asking earlier about what kind of country we want to live in. In that article, which was very well done, the reporters interviewed criminal justice experts and the like, and to a person, people were outraged. I'd never seen anything quite like this. I do think one of the things that we need to do is determine whether that really is such a rare type of a program. But what they'll do, just so people understand what they're doing, if somebody gets in trouble, if somebody is arrested, even if they're not charged, even if they're a suspect, then they're awarded points toward being determined to be some kind of future threat. And once they make this list of people who are, who are up to no good and pose probable future criminals, once they do that, they harass them relentlessly, sending police to visit them up to 6 or 7 times a day, parking police cars outside their houses overnight, trying to embarrass them. As one former police officer put it, we get these people one way or the other. They'll find some kind of violation. In one case, it was, or maybe more than one case, it was your grass is too long, right? So citing people for that. One of these cases, they arrested somebody's father because while they were on the property to harass the family, they saw that there was an underage person smoking a cigarette on the property.
It's worse than that, though. Well, it's worse than that. That one's really, really bad. They not only arrested, but what they did is they walked onto the property with no probable cause and no reasonable articulable suspicion and peered in their windows. They were peeping Toms who saw somebody they believed to be a juvenile smoking a cigarette. And for that, they hauled a guy out of the house and arrested him for contributing to the delinquency of a minor. There's a little case called Hardines versus Florida, Florida versus Hardines. And it describes the fact that the police have an invitation to enter upon your property at any time for 3 specific reasons. One, what's known as a welfare call, where they get information that someone may be in danger. The second reason is, for example, when they are investigating a crime and they are canvassing the neighborhood to look for witnesses. And the third is to warn people who live in a neighborhood about something that is happening. You know, like there's a shooting down the street, please stay in your home kind of thing. They have an inherent invitation to enter upon your property for those reasons.
All that stuff. Just throw it out.
But they don't have, Hezzy, you've got to put it on mute, Hezzy. I'm sorry.
I've been away for 3 months.
Okay.
And,
all right.
So, and it's been there longer. It's just not worth the while.
And the case very simply says
so much
that no,
as well.
You have those, but when they entered upon Mr. Hardines' property, when they entered upon his property for the purposes of having a dog sniff at the door to determine whether there were drugs inside, even Scalia, even Antonin Scalia says that's a search and you have no right to be there. That is a trespass.
Well, those are all that needs to be thrown, but I didn't know what container to put it in.
I sent him an email and I sent him a text message telling him he's got that phone right next to his mouth. Hezzy, you got to put the phone down. Hezzy, you got to put the phone down. We're listening to your whole conversation. Okay?
Okay, I'm down. It should be okay.
Okay, thank you. What happens is that the court said, no, you have a limited invitation. And the truth of the matter is these guys trespassed upon a property. They violated this man's Fourth Amendment rights. They violated his 14th Amendment rights. And for some reason or another, that's okay because they don't like his kid.
Right.
This isn't about adults doing something wrong. This is about juveniles and basically trying to drive parents out of Pasco County and take your kids with you.
Right.
And we hear it. I mean, it's absurd. There's a thing called pretext.
Mm-hmm.
How many deputy sheriffs write citations for people's grass being too long? Or is this a pretext just to knock on a door?
Right.
And enter upon property. It's just wrong. This guy is boss hog. This is my county, and I run my county my way. And I want you gone. Showing up at people's place of work, their employment, multiple times a day to harass them. Where's your kid? Where's your kid? Where's your kid? Trying to get them fired from their jobs. I know that the ACLU and the Southern Poverty Law Center, okay, have filed lawsuits, but they'll wind their way through the federal courts for long periods of time. And what really has to happen is some of these people have got to go to court and get injunctions against this sheriff.
Right.
Now, I don't think there's any judges in circuit court in Pasco County, which is the Sixth Circuit, who will issue those injunctions, but you've got to go to court and make them defend against them. The judges are afraid of the sheriff. The prosecutor's afraid of the sheriff. Everybody's afraid of the sheriff. He's like the cop on the beat. He'd grab an apple off the cart, never paid for it, never offered to pay for it. This is my beat. I get my apples. I mean, everybody's afraid to stand up to him because they'll start harassing you.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? That's what happens when you live in a police state, right? You're next.
Right. I'm the boss. You do what you're told. I want your kid gone, and if that means you have to go, you go too. Okay. And people have literally given up and moved out. We have a colleague who lives in Wesley Chapel, which is part of Pasco County, by the way. And I got to tell you, I feel bad for her. I really do. I have a friend that went to Cooley with me almost 50 years ago who lives in Wesley Chapel too. I feel sorry for him. I feel sorry for anybody who lives up there. You people have to grow up here and vote this guy out. He says, Adam, you really love it. But this is an example of what I got to tell you something. This is an example of what we can expect under a Donald Trump or anybody like him. The Constitution means nothing. It's horrible.
Yep, that's exactly right. That's you know, and you look at the I don't have the article in front of me, but two of the people who are running this program, which now, you know, is developed where it's a multi-million-dollar a year program. One of them is a former counterintelligence officer, and the other is an Army intelligence officer. And it begs the question, what are we doing in local law enforcement agencies adopting tactics and strategies that we get from counterterrorism, right, at the national level?
Yeah,
what
I mean,
is
seriously.
Going on?
I mean, I really just don't understand why this is happening. Well, I do understand why it's happening. I don't understand. You know, there was an old adage that said one man's rights is another man's technicality.
Mm-hmm.
These people must believe that as long as it doesn't affect me, I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, guess what? It is affecting you. You just don't feel the pain yet. But your day is coming. When the sheriff walks in the door and says he wants you to do something and you say no, and your life becomes miserable.
Yeah.
All of a sudden
your nephew
you're getting traffic tickets.
Right.
Yeah. All of a sudden you're getting traffic tickets. I wasn't doing anything wrong. Well, tell it to the judge. Judge, I didn't do anything wrong. Well, I believe the police officer. Because I'm scared of the sheriff. I can't get reelected without the sheriff helping me. I need the sheriff to say good things about me. I'm not impugning the integrity of the people that are sitting on the bench except for where it comes to this guy. I think they're scared of him. No one wants to put the clamps on him. This guy sees Pasco County as being Trump with the United States. I run this place and nobody tells me what to do. Even the Constitution. And there are people that have resigned from his department, which came out in the article, who have resigned from his department because of what he's doing. They're saying, hold on a minute, this is going too far. I want to see what happens when this sheriff's kid steals a pack of gum. Does he get points? Are the deputies going to knock on his door? Oh, no. And there is a tinge of racism in this. Although many of the people that were interviewed in the article are not of color, many, many, many of these 900 families that have been harassed over the last 4 years, okay, are of color. Are we trying to purify our county, Sheriff? This is bad news.
Yeah, it is. And
people,
you know, one of the...
It's...
Yeah. Well, it's so much of it is being done outside of the public view. You know, it's our criminal justice system is supposed to be done out in the open, in a perfect world, of course. That's part of due process. It's part of policing the police, if you will. And here we don't know what algorithms these people are coming up with. We don't know what subjective criteria they're using, because once they compile a list of candidates, right, for future criminals, then they just subjectively go through the list and decide who goes to the top, right, for you know, the most
right.
who wins most harassed, right, citizen this month. And to a certain extent, this also relates to so much of the national discussion we're having of the relationship between police and the people they serve, right? Are they trained to see the people they serve as the enemy, right? I go out there every day on patrol, and everybody I come across during the course of my patrol is a threat to me, or are you there to serve? I don't know. I can't speak for anybody else, but I do not want to live in a place where I can be harassed by the police state because my nephew stole a bike. And I do not want to live in a country where the president can direct investigations of his political enemies. That seems to be the recurring theme of the day, Jeff.
Yeah, it is the recurring theme of the day.
Unfortunately, gentlemen, we have
our time is up.
Our time is up, so we'll have to wait till next week for more exciting and scintillating, discussion. That's
an
great.
Angry conversation.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but that's always good. Wakes people up to reality.
Right.
I don't know if I'd want to wake up to my voice that way, but that's okay.
But for some people, it's a lullaby, Jeff.
Oh,
there you go.
Okay. That's, yeah, that's sweet. There you go.
That is nice. That is nice.
That is nice. That's a nice way to end the day. Thanks, Ezzy.
All right.
Enjoy the week. All the best.
All right.
Have
be well,
Ezzy.
Yep.
All right.
And you
bye
too.
Well. Bye-bye.
You too, Brendan. Bye.
Bye.
Okay. Whoops. I think I may have disconnected the wrong one, but we'll find out soon enough. Good morning. This is Ezzy. Hello? Okay, I can't seem to hear you. Let's see, I don't know.
Hello?
One second. Hello?
Hello, Carlos.
Hello?
Here.
Hi, Carlos.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
I don't know why you can't hear me. It looks, seems like it should be working.
Okay, 1 minute. Carlos, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. All right, so what's the last digit on your phone number that you're calling from?
7.
The last digit. Okay, good. All right, let me just find out. Bear with me one other second. I've got another person there, but I guess they're just listening in. So, first of all, good morning, and thanks for your patience, Carlos. It's a pleasure to speak to you. We should tell people that you are a candidate for the Yonkers City Council District 4.
Right.
So, we're almost at the point where there's going to be the primary. And you're engaged in that primary. You're running against an incumbent. What have you learned so far? Have things changed from the beginning of your campaign effort?
Well, thanks for having me, Ezzy. It's been. I know we had a few weeks where we were sort of in good conversation. I mean, have things changed? And I also want to say, early voting is happening now, so we're actually in
yes.
primary right now. So people are able to go to the polls, and people have been going to the polls and reporting back that they're voting for me, so I'm feeling good about that. I guess things change because, at first we were not a candidate, right? I was running to get on the ballot, mm-hmm. and I was running
right.
as a first-time candidate. My opponent is also a first-time Democratic primary candidate, to be sure. So it's his first time running in a Dem
parties.
Primary. Right. So he won as a Republican.
Parties.
Right
mm-hmm.
on. So what has changed is, people thinking I had no shot. And, I spent a lot of time in court because, I was trying to get thrown off. People were trying to throw me off the ballot. And so I went
mm-hmm.
up to the Court of Appeals all the way up. And now that that failed miserably, and now I'm on the ballot. We're dealing with the next phase of of barriers, and so a lot has changed. But what has been great is people are really excited. They're glad to have a progressive option. Democrats haven't had a primary in this district for over a decade, so you know, I see a lot of excitement, a lot of really positive feedback from the people. So lots has changed, lots has remained the same. You know, it's only been a few months, so it's funny how campaign
That's
time
true
works.
Too. Well, you know what I didn't realize until started to look into it, with the you can now do early voting and or absentee ballot, which is now regarded as the same thing. You have the option of choosing what you will. You don't have to be necessarily handicapped or sick or whatever to not attend. But what I found really overwhelming is I didn't realize that if people subscribe to get an early vote in, their name was published, and it was public knowledge. And I don't know why that needed to be, because when you go to vote, when you go to vote without telling anybody that you're actually going to be attending at the voting booth area, nobody knows that you've come to vote, and nobody knows who specifically voted in a particular district, but they know that a certain number of people voted in a district, so they count numbers, but they don't know names. But here, with early voting, or your name becomes public, and I think that gives affords people who want to threaten some people, you know, to force them not to conceivably vote, because they might get harassed. I don't even know why they would have some law like that that permitted this to become public knowledge. But I wonder if that'll change in the future. So what do people in your district want? What are they looking for? Oh, you know why? I mentioned that only because we expected a lot of people to vote early, but they haven't.
Right.
The numbers are very disappointing.
Right.
And maybe that's the reason why.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, my understanding is all voting records are public, so you can find out if anyone voted any time. Like, you can look me up and see my voting record. You can look anyone up and find out
whether or not they voted. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Now, that's my understanding. So maybe there's something for us both to sort of dig deeper into. But everyone's voting record, whether they voted or not, is public. You know.
Okay, so just voting or not is public, but not which way you voted.
Correct.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, still have to look into it further, but a very interesting prospect.
Sure. right.
When you've been going around, when you go around and people get to know you, they know what you look like now, maybe they didn't before, what do they ask you to focus your attention on should you become, you know, victorious in this primary?
Sure. Well, first I'll say, you know, they're telling me to ignore all the comments under the thread that you've been allowing them to post. You know, you've got a lot of rough. You're putting a lot of rough stuff out there, and I don't know.
What can I tell
you? I know you got, you know, you're doing your thing, but they're telling me to ignore all that stuff, you know, and so that's been nice, you know. There's a lot of strange comments about, you know, irrelevant things that, you know, would be nice if they weren't up, but I understand you've got a thing going on. So the people are very
go ahead. Yeah, sure.
Thanks. Yeah. So, look, Carlos, I wouldn't say the problem. They're saying, look, ignore all those things. We're excited about you, Carlos. We want someone who's going to focus on us, focus on the things that matter, someone who's able to ignore the noise, you know. It's back to the basics, you know. It's not basic, but it feels basic in our political climate, right? It's like we do need people to focus on the roads on a consistent basis. We do need people to focus on street lighting, not decorative lighting, right? We do need people to focus on the garbage issue, the quality of life things that people have been talking about and haven't been tended to by our current council person. So those sorts of things, that, you know, I mean, now my opponent is like, you know, showing off all the things that magically he's done. But when you talk to people, I mean, they say, look, we haven't heard from this guy. Like, we've been reaching out. We haven't heard anything. So the people have a real consistent story, and they're excited, and I'm excited to do that work. Like, I'm very much interested in, you know, figuring out the street lighting issue. I mean, it sounds sort of it may sound a little comical, but it's like a real important issue that people have raised consistently. So, you know, they're excited. I'm excited. We just need to get people out to vote. Like you said, it's been a low turnout. I spent some time at the polls over the weekend, and I will continue to be sort of, you know, around. People can go to any poll in the county, any polling site in the county. So it's a lot of polling sites to cover, but yeah. So
I think whatever the public in the district you want to represent feel it's important, it is important. The problem in the past is that we have a lot of people who just make believe that they're going to do this, that, or the other, and don't, or they easily forget about
right.
it once they get
right.
elected. So, and people are looking at your campaign as a breath of fresh air, and that's encouraging. Unfortunately, on a website like ours in a city where there's retribution to be exacted if people know your IP address or if they know your name, it can undermine people. They could lose jobs. They could have their children threatened. It's a weird environment.
I'm getting all sorts of threats.
Just,
way.
yeah,
we're getting a
know,
lot
and,
of that,
and,
you know.
Well, but that's the real Yonkers, and I can't ostracize people because of those. Some of the stuff is so off the top and over the wall that it's insane. So very hard to figure out at times. And sometimes rather than people saying what they believe or you would think, they would explain themselves a little bit more. They just say, oh, this one's no good. These are not comments that mean very much, not in my book. They're just to disparage other people. So what is it you don't really like about a candidate? That's important. What do you like about a candidate is probably more important. Since you're getting a lot of response from people who are supporting of you, what do they hope that you'll be able to accomplish? What are we doing about the senior center? Is that an important issue? The roads, is that an important issue? What became the most important for you that you heard?
Yeah, look, I think they're all important, and that's where, you know, it becomes really difficult, right? Like, how do we prioritize what comes first? You know, like how do we do that? But I think that the main thing is what you said earlier, which is, you know, not losing sight of these things, right? Like there's a way that somehow our local officials, and not just us in Yonkers, I think this is like local governments generally, lose sight of these conversations that we have on the campaign trail. So I think it's going to be really important for me to continue to be in touch with people, and that's my commitment, is to continue to do things like town halls, continue to walk the streets after election day, continue to, you know, meet people and talk with people in an honest, genuine sense to, you know, when I worked in higher ed, we used to say to have the student pulse, you know, and in this sense, I want to have the people's pulse, right? It's the same sort of idea. It's like, how do we continue to be engaged with my constituents? So that I don't lose sight of, so that I don't say, oh, I put some street lighting up, it's done. And, you know, and then I miss the fact that there were some corners that we didn't get to, right? So I don't want to, you know. So anyways, it's all important. But I think if I can continue to engage people, they're pretty consistent. And they, you know, people will prioritize for you. You know, it's fine. I mean, you know, we're all grown people. We've all been here for, a lot of people have been here 40, 50 years, you know. So it's like, all right, you all know the issues. Just help me, you know, help me prioritize. And that's my collaborative way. Some people are like, oh, well, you know, as a public official, you're supposed to tell us what to do. I'm like, no. We have to do this collaboratively, you know. And I'm sort of a, I'm a conduit, you know, for the constituent needs. And I bring that to the council, and then we get it done, right? So that's my, yeah.
Well, my takeaway from what you're telling me is that basically that you, what we don't have in many of our elected officials is they don't respond, they don't react to the public interest or the public sentiment. So they just gloss it over as if it didn't exist, or they didn't hear, or they don't want to hear, whatever. And I guess it's not such a difficult thing to do, but the most powerful message is the message that you respond to the public. And, you know, certainly I've always offered an opportunity for people, even if they get into elected office, to speak on a regular basis to the public.
Mm-hmm.
And there, we've always accepted letters to the editor from any candidate. And a lot of them, they get elected and it's all forgotten. It's not, it doesn't hurt me.
Yeah, I don't understand that.
I got news to write, you know?
Right,
and there are a lot of things to write about. But they forget because they think they're in for 4 years.
Right,
that's not good enough. And
I agree.
So I think that's we've learned that today, that if people were quiet, keep people were silent, we would never move ahead as a society, whether it be on the national stage, on the state stage, or the city stage, or the county. And that's what's important. You got to talk. You got to speak up. You got to say what's on your mind. And you allow people to respond back. That's why I allow the comments, not because I like them all. I just don't want to shut people out.
And you know what?
And some
I
of them
respect
are ugly.
That, you know? Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead. I'll respond afterwards.
It's okay. I'm good. I'm coming.
Yeah, I was gonna say I respect that. You know, I think that, like, you know, that's why I keep coming on, because I want to keep talking and I'm not, you know, running away from conversation. You know, I'm like, this is part of doing real community local work includes having tough conversations. You know, and so I understand that. And that's part of,
well, you remember we would talk about issues a few weeks ago, and I apologize for my error because I didn't realize you could have two committees. The thing that's interesting about that is, did you ever find if your opponent actually filed his returns?
I haven't found it
in a timely manner.
Filing. I'm continuing to look. I haven't found. We've continued to look. And there's a second filing date a few days ago, which we filed for. If you found, I'd love to see, but I haven't found anything on his end.
I haven't, to be honest with you. I'm so busy since I got out of hospital and rehab.
Right.
I'm going back and forth. It's like the doctors have me under their spell, and there's not much I can do about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to do what they do. It's lucky that they leave me alone for a couple of hours on radio.
I hear you.
But that's very interesting. That does it matter to people if the filings are made? Evidently not, because I don't hear a pushback. That's the thing that is troubling.
I think a lot of people, for the most part, most people don't really. I think most people don't care about local politics to begin with. That's the first thing we'll say, right? Like, that's just the way. Most people don't care about politics generally. Then most people don't care about local politics, right? But the thing that's important, and the reason why I'm interested in my opponent's filings is because I spent over a month in court at the Supreme Court level, Westchester County.
Right.
Then I went to the appellate division, the second division in New York State, And then had to go to the Court of Appeals to defend my petitions, which will allow me to be on the ballot. So, and then there was a third candidate in this race who also had to go to the Westchester County Supreme Court with the same exact challenger, with virtually the same petition challenges and the same attorney. And so I'm curious to know how much money was spent trying to avoid a primary. And I think that's important to know, you know, $100,000 was spent trying to keep, you know, no election to happen. I think that's critical information for people to know, you know. And I mean, the other thing is, you know, it is important to know, you know, where people are getting their money from. You know, people are bashing me for where I'm getting my money from. They're saying that they're crazy socialist communists. But, you know, my opponent...
Well, I don't know how they define you that way. Most people today don't even know what a socialist is or a communist.
We talked about that. But what we know from the past from my opponent's filings is that he's gotten a lot of money from development companies. He's gotten a lot of money from construction management companies. So we don't have any of that information on this race. We have zero on this race.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that stuff is important. I mean, we can guess because, you know, it's sometimes obvious. But, you know, I don't want to make, you know, I'm not here to sort of make false allegations or speculation. It's just nice to have,
mm-hmm.
you know, we're required by the state to file. So where's the filing so we can actually talk about it?
Right.
But that's
all.
That's
why
it's important in this race.
Well, I think those things are important. I still think that one can make a local government relevant if one is responsive to the people that they were elected to govern. You know, so you're doing
their
bidding.
The
you're supposed to be their yeah. So
right,
I think people would become more involved if they felt pure and comfortable in the people that represent them.
I agree.
You make that on your own. It's, you know, it's a question of ethics. If you tell people one thing and you don't abide by your own word, then your word means nothing and you're not credible. If you can build credibility by saying one thing and then following up, that's a godsend and it's a gift. And I can't see why people wouldn't be involved in a campaign like that.
That's right.
So that's everything in a nutshell. And it's an ethical standard.
That's why we have.
It's a standard that works.
That's right. That's why I've got this responsive platform, and I'm dying to continue responding. You know, once we get through this election cycle, you know, we'll continue to be responsive. That's it's just the way I operate. So it's nice to, you know, hear that.
Well, you're only running in the Democratic primary, and so like, what do you expect to happen? What would you do if you don't win the primary? What do you do if you do win the primary? Or have you even thought about that?
Look, I'm obsessed with this election, so it's all I think about all the time, you know. But
that's good.
I think the smart thing for me is to get through June 22nd and then make a decision. You know, it's like when you get a job offer, you know, when you're interviewing for a job, you sort of wait till you get the offer in hand, and then you make a decision on whether you take it or not. You know, so
I got
that's,
you. Okay.
That's my approach. I will hopefully we don't lose touch. So you know, we'll talk ideally on the 22nd and maybe the week after, and we can figure out.
Well, you're always welcome. You're always welcome. So it's not like I don't push people to the side. I don't at all. You know, so
right.
I don't have a problem with that. It's a platform, and it's a platform where. You can also, even people who lose have at times just been able to come back. There's no reason not to. And they have new ideas and they could reinvent themselves, and that's good too. So that's all very encouraging. So there are a lot of things in that district. It seems that the 4th district has been laid fallow for a very long time. I don't know why, and yet that was a really very powerful section of the city. And I don't know, it seems to have waned somehow, and I don't understand why. I don't know what caused it to wane. I really have no idea. The district also incorporates the casino, doesn't it?
Yes, yes it does.
So, and there's a lot of industry there as well. Great places to shop and stuff. Supermarkets.
Exactly, the mall. Yeah. Right, right.
Yeah.
Right.
So there's a lot going on there. And then good schools as well. So a lot of it is, the way people want to live. So something's missing, evidently. I don't know exactly what it is. I don't know it well enough.
I'll go out on a limb and say it's just what we were talking about a second ago. You know, the engagement of the people, the engagement of the associations. You know, we have You know, we have people here who are invested and very vocal and you know, I think it might be a bit of a missed opportunity to engage them thoughtfully. And so I'm looking forward to doing that and continuing to get to know people. But it might just be as simple as that, or it might be a little more complicated, you know.
Never know.
Or a little bit of both. Right.
Well, we have an opportunity to talk next week as well, because Tuesday is your day. So that'll be encouraging on the day of the actual vote itself. And and then how do people get in touch with your campaign now if they don't know enough about you already?
Oh, that's great. Yeah. If they want more Carlos, sorry. my website.
Yeah, hey,
and
Carlos,
I'm looking forward
all
to
the
talking
time.
To you. I'm looking forward to talking with you on the day of. It'll be a crazy day. But my website is carlos4yonkers.com. That's the number 4. So Carlos, the number 4 yonkers.com, like District 4.
Yeah.
The email is carlos4yonkers@gmail.com. So very simple, very consistent. All the social media is at carlos4yonkers. And then the phone number, if you want to give me a call, 914-294-4769. And I've had some great phone calls, people just sort of calling me about issues, you know, animal rights things recently. So anyway, give me a call.
Yeah, animal rights is a big issue as well. And I think we forgot about that quite a bit. But it's a very huge following.
Yes, No, I'm excited to think about expanding the shelter and you know, really just sort of thinking about a spay and neuter option. We don't even have one in the city, so we've got some really great work to do in that area.
Do you think also with the funding that's coming from the federal government to the state and then will be dispersed into the city of Yonkers as well, do you think that, if you were elected to office, that there would be, just a way of expressing the needs in the district as well? I wonder if the needs will be dispersed equally among all 6 districts.
Well, I like to think about equitably distributing things, right? So, I mean, I am all about, like, I want my district to get all the things, but I need to think equitably across the district because, you know, there are different needs across the district. So, having that equity mind is going to be really important. And then recentering the people, you know, doubling down on our commitment to our constituents is really where I'll have a strong impact on the council in those conversations, saying, hey, remember this one issue that keeps coming up. We have to make sure we fit it in, things like that. So, I'm excited for what we can do here, and I'm excited for what we can do across the city. I think I'm the kind of person that will be thoughtful in being smart about equitably distributing.
Well, I think that's the name of the game, so that's really cool. Well, I appreciate you making the time. Thank you very much, and I'm looking forward to speaking to you next week on primary day. All
Me
the best.
Me too. All right, be well.
All right. Thank you very much. Have a great day. Carlos Burgos, he's a candidate for the Yonkers City Council District 4, and so might as well remember his name. Now, let me go back to this one other number that's been here on the studio screen. Did you have a question or anything you wanted to say? Or are you just listening in? Okay. No problem. I appreciate that. Okay. So what we're going to do now is I'll put you in our silent room so you can hear the program, no problem. And then what I'm going to do is we're going to cover some other news. So bear with me a moment. I find my notes. 1 second. All right. Okay, well, evidently we have new government in Israel and we also have strife. Israeli nationalists are going to march in East Jerusalem as Palestinians call for a day of rage in response. So far-right Israeli groups will march in and around East Jerusalem's Old City, that's actually today, in a flag-waving procession that risks igniting tensions with Palestinians in the contested city and rekindling violence between Israel and Gaza militants. So assailing the march as a provocation, Palestinian factions have called for a day of rage in Gaza and the West Bank, and Gaza's Islamist rulers, Hamas, have warned of renewed hostilities if it goes ahead. Quote, we warn of the dangerous repercussions that may result from the occupying power's intention to allow extremist Israeli settlers to carry out the flag march in occupied Jerusalem tomorrow. That's what Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh said on Twitter. An original march was rerouted to avoid the Old City's Muslim quarter on May 10, when tensions in Jerusalem led Gaza's Islamist rulers Hamas to fire rockets toward the Holy City, helping set off 11 days of deadly fighting. Now, Israeli rightists accused their government of caving into Hamas by changing its route. They rescheduled the procession after a Gaza truce took hold. And today's march, is due to begin at 6:30 p.m. That's local time there. It poses an immediate challenge for the new Israeli Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, who took office on Sunday and brought veteran leader Benjamin Netanyahu's record-long rule of 12 years to an end. Now, Bennett's internal security minister approved the march on Monday. So a route change or cancellation of the procession could expose Bennett's patchwork coalition to accusations from Netanyahu, now in the opposition, and his right-wing allies of giving Hamas veto power over events in Jerusalem. So the time has come for Israel to threaten Hamas and not for Hamas to threaten Israel. That's what a prominent far-right lawmaker, Itamar Ben-Gvir, said on Twitter. An official route for the march has yet to be announced. Israeli media reported that police will allow participants to congregate outside the Old City's Damascus Gate, but will not let them cross through it to the Muslim quarter, which has an overwhelmingly Palestinian population. So tensions are sure to be high whether or not the route is changed. Palestinian protests were planned for 6 p.m. across the Gaza Strip, and Hamas and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah faction have called on Palestinians to flock to the Old City to counter the march. Well, the Israeli military has made preparations for a possible escalation in Gaza over the march. Israeli media reported that, and the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem prohibited its employees and their families from entering the Old City today. Now, Palestinians want East Jerusalem, which includes the Old City, to be the capital of the state they seek to establish in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. Israel, which annexed East Jerusalem after capturing the area in the 1967 war, regards the entire city as its capital. So the struggles still continue, as they say. So let's look at some other things that are on the international scale, which we need to cover. Bear with me a moment. Gotta get to my pages. 1 second. This is really interesting as well. The United States and the European Union have reached a deal to end the 17-year Airbus-Boeing trade dispute. Well, the United States and European Union reached a deal on Tuesday today to end a damaging dispute over subsidies to rival plane makers Boeing and Airbus and phase out billions of dollars in punitive tariffs, the U.S. trade envoy had said. The U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai said the two sides have come to terms on a five-year agreement to suspend the tariffs at the center of the dispute. She said they could be re-implemented if U.S. companies are not able to compete fairly with those in Europe. Now, today's announcement resolves a long-standing irritant in the United States-EU relationship, Tai had said, as President Joe Biden met with European Union leaders in Brussels. Quote, instead of fighting with one of our closest allies, we are finally coming together against a common threat, end quote. Well, the trade dispute skyrocketed under the Trump administration and saw tit-for-tat duties slapped on a range of companies that have nothing to do with aircraft production, from French winemakers to German cookie bakers in Europe and U.S. spirits producers in the United States, among many others. Well, the U.S. imposed what could have amounted to $7.5 billion in tariffs on European exports back in 2019, after the World Trade Organization ruled that the European Union had not complied with its rulings on subsidies for Airbus, which is based on in France, and the European Union retaliated last November with up to $4 billion in punitive duties after the World Trade Organization ruled that the United States had provided illegal subsidies to Seattle-based Boeing. Well, in March, weeks after Biden had taken office, the two sides agreed to suspend the tariffs. And that suspension started on March 11 for 4 months. The new agreement will officially go into effect on July 11. Well, this really opens a new chapter in our relationship because we move from litigation to cooperation on aircraft after 17 years of dispute, said European Commissioner, Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. She's of German extraction. And both aides said they would also work together to analyze and address the, quote, non-market practices of third parties that may harm our large civil aircraft sectors, according to the European Union executive branch. Well, Tai said that they would cooperate, quote, to challenge and counter China's non-market practices in this sector in specific ways that reflect our standards for fair competition, end quote. Well, Airbus, which is headquartered in France, but also has centers in Germany and Spain, welcomed the agreement. Quote, this will provide the basis to create a level playing field, which we have advocated for since the start of this dispute. It will also avoid lose-lose tariffs that are only adding to the many challenges that our industry faces, an Airbus spokesperson said in a statement. France's finance and European affairs minister also hailed the deal. Quote, we are now going to be able to focus on finally putting these differences behind us and to define the conditions for fair competition on a global scale to support the aerospace sector, which is strategic for both Europe and the United States, they said in a joint statement. Now, despite the breakthrough, the deal does not end the Trump-era transatlantic trade row. The former U.S. president also slapped duties on European Union steel and aluminum, and that move enraged European countries, most of them NATO allies, because it was justified as a measure to protect U.S. national security. So the so-called Article 232 proceeding both hurts European producers and raises the cost of steel for American companies. The European Union retaliated by raising tariffs on products like U.S.-made motorcycles, bourbon, peanut butter, and jeans. Go figure. So those are some of the issues there. Now, there are other concerns. Bear with me a moment. One moment here. Where are we? I'm looking for one other thing.
it here. Oh, yeah, here it is, on Peru. A divided Peru is awaiting election results as the vote count nears completion. A lot of people in Yonkers that are from Peru. Well, Peruvians were still waiting on Monday for their next president to be confirmed more than a week after a polarizing runoff vote with socialist Pedro Castillo clinging to a narrow lead that would tilt the country firmly to the left. Well, the election count, which has increased by less than 0.02% since Saturday and stands at 99.953% tallied, showed the former teacher with 50.14% of the vote, fewer than 50,000 votes ahead of right-wing rival Keiko Fujimori. Fujimori has alleged electoral fraud without offering any concrete proof of her claim. Castillo, 51, little known before a surprise win in the first round vote in April, has rattled the copper-rich Andean country's political and business elite with plans to redraft the constitution and sharply hike taxes on mining. He has said that Peruvians have already, quote, chosen their path, end quote, and his far-left Free Peru Party has hailed victory, despite attempts by Fujimori to annul some votes that went against her, holding up the official confirmation of the result. It's still unclear when the country's electoral body will formally announce the winner, though Castillo has called for the count to be wrapped up quickly to end the uncertainty. Fujimori, who is 46, is the daughter of ex-president Alberto Fujimori, who is serving jail time for corruption and human rights abuses and has vowed to fight until the last vote is counted. While listening to the radio and the vote count in her corner store in Lima, Magali Roca said she voted for Castillo in the second round, although he was not initially her preferred candidate. Fujimori was even less so, she said. She's been putting up too many obstacles, said the 42-year-old. All the time she had the majority in Congress, she blocked everything. She's the reason we haven't moved forward before. I don't consider her capable of ruling. Now, Carlos Guramendi, 66, who works as a porter in a residential district, said he had reluctantly cast his vote for Fujimori. I voted for the lesser of two evils, he said. No, Guramendi considers the political situation an embarrassment, but as if there could have been fraud, it wouldn't be anything unusual. Well, Castillo's party has rejected Fujimori's fraud accusations, and international observers in Lima have said that the elections were carried out cleanly. Well, if confirmed, Castillo's win would be a boon to the region's political left. The socialist, who hails from a poor area of northern Peru, has galvanized rural voters who feel left behind in the country's growth story. Flavio Quispe, who is originally from Puno, that's all the way in the south, right across Lake Titicaca in southern Peru, but now runs a small business in the capital, said he voted for Castillo. Now, the people were abandoned, said the 70-year-old of the government in his home province. They made so many promises, but not even water arrived. In a busy Lima market where her family had been selling fresh fish for more than three decades, Monica said she had not voted in the runoff, but she was worried about drastic changes under Castillo. I won't wait until this country turns into another Venezuela. Now my plan is to go where my family is, the United States, the 52-year-old said, declining to give her surname in case it put her plans at risk. Castillo has sought to appease financial markets with a moderate left platform, but it remains unclear if his administration will ultimately revert to the party's roots as a far-left organization. A Venezuelan migrant working as a manicurist said she was terrified of a Castillo presidency. She declined to give her name for fear of deportation, as she had been living in Peru undocumented since 2019. I left Venezuela because our country had been destroyed, she said. It's very sad what happened in these elections. We've already lived through this, end quote. Well, rising levels of poverty have also cast a harsh spotlight on inequality between the poor and traditional political elites, which has been intensified by the world's deadliest per capita COVID-19 outbreak.
marches by supporters of both candidates have broken out in Lima over the past week, with voters in favor of Castillo arriving from rural areas and Fujimori supporters backing her accusations of fraud. Well, United Nations Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet of Chile expressed concern about increasing tensions. Quote, electoral institutions and the decisions they make must be respected and accepted, she tweeted, if the rules of democracy are not accepted before, during, and after the elections, it can create dangerous cracks in social cohesion. So major, major concerns, to say the least. But wherever you look, there are problems. Now, let me just quickly check one other thing. Bear with me a moment. One second. Yeah, I wanted to mention this to you as well. Evidently, a Syrian hospital has been destroyed in a deadly shell attack in Afrin, which is in the north. At least 18 people were killed, including doctors, after shells hit the Al-Shifa hospital in Afrin, which is in northern Syria, on Sunday, leaving the maternity ward and emergency room in ruins. And France Enquête reported from the town controlled by the Turkish-backed opposition fighters, where local authorities placed the blame on Kurdish rebels. So the windows were shattered, much of the ceiling has collapsed, and blood still stains the floor of the Al-Shifa hospital in Afrin. The hospital was crowded when two shells hit the structure 2 days ago. There was an attack on the city near the hospital, and injured police were brought there. And hospital director Hassan Adnan explained, an hour later, a rocket hit it, destroyed both the maternity ward and here, the emergency unit. It's not clear who was behind the attack. There were also wounded dozens and came from areas where both Syrian government troops and Kurdish alleged fighters are deployed. Although the Syrian American Medical Society, which operates in the hospital, has called for an investigation into the deadly attack, local authorities do not seem to see much need, pointing the finger at Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's biggest foes, Kurdish rebels. While attending the NATO summit in Brussels on Monday, the Turkish leader suggested the attack on Afrin was an attack on the alliance's southern border. Syrian Democratic Forces, meanwhile, reject the accusation against the Kurdish militias, and regional observers believe the attack was staged by groups fighting on behalf of Iran or the Syrian regime. So same story, different day. One second here. 1 minute here. 1 moment. Looking for one other story. One moment here. All right, I'm just not sure where this is, where I put it. Bear with me a little further, forgive me. I'll go check one other thing here. Okay, no, I think I mentioned this situation to you yesterday about Myanmar's junta's show trial of the ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi had begun yesterday. So there's nothing we need to cover there. And one second. All right, I think that we've covered everything that we can today. I think that's it. So we'll speak to you tomorrow. And let me just see who was on for tomorrow. I don't remember. Tomorrow's Wednesday. We'll see who's on tomorrow. Okay. I'm not exactly sure, because normally we speak to Oren M. Levin-Waldman,
but he's out of the country. And so we need to fill up the first hour from 10 to 11. And then I think we have Sean Patterson Howard in the last half hour from 11:30 to 12. And we'll see who else in the meantime. So that's the story there. All right, so I think we're cool. Speak to you tomorrow. All the best. Let me go back to our studio screen. And then we'll be able to shut down for the day. Okay. 1 minute. Okay. Something's happened, so we'll have to see what went wrong here. There we are. Okay. Have a great day. We'll speak to you tomorrow. Goodbye.